rejection mimics other things that are more common in pediatrics, right? Like infectious issues, like gastro. I think it's important to always have your antenna up for rejection in these patients as they come through the ER or ICU and you're triaging their calls.
Welcome back to Pete's Grit. I'm Zach Hodges, a pediatric ICU fellow from UT Southwestern in Dallas.
And I'm Alice Shanklin, a critical care fellow in Washington, D.C.
So we have a very exciting topic today. Alice, what are we talking about?
Today is part two of our orthotopic heart transplant episode. We're talking about both the first post-op night and what happens through the years. I learned so much. I feel that this episode really made me a better provider in every way.
I agree completely. And to do that, we have two guests. First is Dr. Warren Zuckerman. He's an associate professor of pediatrics at Columbia and a pediatric heart failure specialist and heart transplant specialist at Morgan Stanley Children's Hospital. Research interests, they're very much involved in the heart transplant in the pediatric population.
Yes, and we're so lucky that Gav recruited him for this episode. Gav Apfel is a CICU hospitalist at Columbia. He did his residency there and will be joining their critical care fellowship program next year. We can't wait until he's a CICU attending that we can text. Let's get right to the episode. I'd love to hear specifically when they're coming post-op, what vasoactive support and even the presence or absence of nitric is normal to you and what is a little abnormal, and then how, once you go through that first post-op night, how do you know that your patient is doing well?
So I think there's a pretty wide range for what I would consider to be a normal first post-operative night in these patients. And again, we grade on a curve. I'm actually not joking. Definitely will text my colleagues and they'll text me based on who's on for the first postoperative night and ask for a letter grade. We grade on a curve. Your straightforward dilated going into surgery is very different than your failed Fontan, certainly different than a congenital heart patient on a VAD going into a transplant. I think that all of our patients come out of the operating room, generally speaking, on at least a small dose of epinephrine. The donor hearts are catechol depleted. You are severing the nerve connection when you cut out the hearts. So they have limited heart rate responsiveness. We've had patients in the past who have had issues with an acute vagal event, drop their heart rate acutely, and these patients have trouble with heart rate response immediately postoperatively. So we keep catechols on board. Generally speaking, again, with epinephrine, sometimes you run into issues with hypertension. So in those cases, we sometimes use dobutamine. You do have the ability to have backup pacing in the event that you have an acute hypertensive issue and you need to come off epinephrine. So we do have these patients on epinephrine, and like I said, almost universally they're on right ventricular support with either milrinone or dobutamine. Nitric oxide is probably used in a lot of our patients coming out of the operating room or early in the postoperative first day and first night for right ventricular support based on what the echo looks like, based on what the perfusion of the patient looks like, based on acid-base status. So we're pretty aggressive about that. So it doesn't necessarily bother me if we have patients on nitric oxide. I kind of think patients on epinephrine, another inotrope, and nitric oxide are your standard patient. We very rarely look to extubate our patient in the first 24 hours after a transplant. It certainly happens in our rare, really, really straightforward patients who are doing incredibly well, I would say 24 hours after the transplant. But we're certainly looking at least 1 to 3 days with that breathing tube in place. I think that's kind of what we're thinking for the first 24 hours or so after transplant.
Is there a specific time frame you want to keep the catechols on? I know, at least from what I've seen in the unit, we say like a minimum of 5 days sometimes, even if they are hemodynamically stable. What determines that decision?
Yeah, I can tell you, we generally do it for 4 to 5 days. When I was a junior attending, I had one patient who was hypertensive, so we actually left them on a pacer and a very, very small amount of epinephrine. Came off the epinephrine, they were still being paced. When we checking for what the underlying heart rate is, it was a flat line.
Wow.
And that was probably about 3 days after transplant. I assume it would have come back. When I say it was a flat line, it was probably because I checked for 5 seconds and the patient actually was extubated, so they felt it. Turned that pacer right back up. I was probably my first year out of fellowship, called Linda Ananizio, who's been the boss here forever, and she was like, I told you to leave the epinephrine on for 4 or 5 days.
Wow.
So you see, you do see some limited heart rate response sometimes. That was probably a rare case and an outlier. But since that day, I've always kept a little bit of catechol on board for about 4 or 5 days.
I'll take it.
Yeah.
Wow. So we have this kid. He's on his catechols. He's on his respiratory support. What would make you start thinking possible primary graft failure? How would you make that diagnosis? And then how would you treat it?
Primary graft failure is when we talk about doing evaluations of our recipients for listing and when we evaluate donors, the thing we're trying to avoid is primary graft failure. Primary graft failure is the leading cause of mortality in the first month after a heart transplant. I think it accounts for like half of the mortality almost. It is not immunologic. So it basically means you put in the new heart and it doesn't work well enough. Within the first 24 hours, if you are escalating your inotropic support to above 2 inotropes, I consider that primary graft failure. We're pretty aggressive about using nitric oxide, so I wouldn't necessarily say for patients on 2 inotropes and nitric oxide that they're having primary graft failure. But if you're on that regimen and you are having evidence of diminished heart function, meaning poor perfusion, poor acid-base status, rising CVP, and you're needing to react to that, I consider that primary graft failure. The way we generally handle it, increased sedation. Sometimes we even have to keep these patients paralyzed. We're pretty aggressive about that in our patients that we know are going into the transplant with high pulmonary vascular resistance. Generally, I would consider somebody with a PVR, index to body surface area, above 4.5 or so to have elevated PVR. We know going into that transplant, when those patients come back, we're going to be really aggressive with sedation and paralysis, plan to keep them intubated for at least 3 or 4 days to minimize any bumps that you might see in the PVR to keep that heart as happy and healthy as possible. There are also times where you're escalating your inotropic support, you're not seeing the response that you want, that we have to consider using temporary mechanical circulatory support in these patients. Surgeons will make that decision in the operating room with our team and with anesthesia, of course, come out of the operating room on ECMO and we'll rest the heart for a couple of days. We can use temporary RVAD support if it is really, truly isolated to the right ventricle. We do that once in a while as well. But most typically, we'll leave these patients on ECMO coming out of the operating room. Or there are some patients for sure that the surgeons will leave the chest open coming out of the operating room. That way, we can make a relatively quick decision in the intensive care unit if we need to go back onto ECMO support. So our surgeons will help closely manage patients who we consider borderline. Again, one of the decision points in the operating room is coming off bypass. Another decision point in the operating room is closing the chest. We see very, very little harm in leaving the chest open. Obviously, there's infection risk, especially when you're going to immunosuppress the patient. But for a day or two, I think the benefit of leaving the chest open to help with hemodynamics, chest closure does put pressure on the heart, especially on the right ventricle, and to help with the ease of going onto mechanical circulatory support if necessary.
Oh, definitely a spectrum of, is this graft going to fly in this patient? And then what do we do if not?
The other thing I should say is very, very aggressive following of certain parameters. CVP is a very important thing to keep an eye on. And to give a hard and fast number is probably not the right thing because every patient is different. You see what your patients look like coming out of the operating room, what their acid-base status is, what their perfusion is, what their CVP is at that time, and you get an idea for where they're in a good spot. But if that CVP is rising, the RV could just, again, it blows up and fails. So if you see rising CVP with issues with acidosis or poor perfusion, then it gives you an alert that your RV is not happy. So again, CVP, but also acid-base status, always on top of getting our blood gases, looking at lactate issues. Lactate's a tricky number, though. In our post-op transplant patients, we see a lot of lactate washout. So I think not just the lactate alone, but the actual blood gas and what your acid-base status is, we're pretty vigilant about keeping an eye on that, especially, again, in patients with high pulmonary vascular resistance.
Nice. Let's pivot to immunosuppression. Generally, what's your strategy? What's happening on the first post-op night? How can new primary providers think about this?
So I do think that every center might do things a little bit differently. One of the major decision points in immunosuppression for post-op transplant patients is whether you're going to use induction therapy. I think most centers around the country do generally use induction therapy. We generally use induction therapy, although there are certain patients that I'll talk about in a second where we don't. And what we use for induction therapy is pretty aggressive immunosuppression. So we use ATG, or antithymocyte globulin, which is a pretty strong medicine at wiping out all cell lines. We use that for the first post-op night, and it's given generally 5 doses on a daily basis. We try to give our first dose within 6 hours of the operating room. To take a step back, in the operating room, when the cross clamp comes off, everybody gets a pretty whopping dose of solumedrol. We give 20 milligrams per kilogram of that. Sometimes results in high blood sugars and high blood pressures. High blood pressures we love coming out of the operating room. And then the ATG, again, is given around 6 hours postoperatively. The ATG can cause hypotension. So we need to be on top of our patients' blood pressures, vital signs, and hemodynamic status to make that decision with the ICU team on whether we're going to give that first dose of ATG at 6 hours. We can delay it sometimes, but if we're going to delay it for a significant amount of time, we come up with other immunosuppression strategies. But generally, we use ATG daily for 5 days, and we introduce our maintenance immunosuppression. The regimen we use here is tacrolimus, is a calcineurin inhibitor. Cellcept is an anti-metabolite. We start those at postoperative day 2 and 5, respectively, and that's the maintenance immunosuppression that patients will use going forward. There are some other strategies for induction immunotherapy that do exist, such as medications like basiliximab, which we use very rarely here. They're a little bit more friendly on the vital signs. We think of them as a little bit less aggressive immunosuppression. Some centers tailor their ATG dosing to cell counts. So they'll do CBCs and look at actual T-cell counts, CBCs and T-cell panels, to tailor their ATG dosing. We actually do, after 3 days, look at our T-cell counts, and we have a certain cutoff for whether we're going to complete those 5 doses or leave it at 3. I don't think it's that crucial in terms of like ICU management, whether you're using 3 versus 5 doses of ATG. But I think whether you're using ATG in general is something that's important to know, because it leaves you severely immunosuppressed and it can certainly affect your blood pressure. We have seen some of our patients with congenital heart disease and protein-losing enteropathy. These patients go into the transplant relatively immunosuppressed from loss of proteins and loss of antibodies. We've seen early findings of infection and or PTLD, or post-transplant lymphoproliferative disease, in these patients when they get aggressively immunosuppressed. So we have tailored our immunosuppression protocol in this patient population. We generally do not actually give them induction therapy. And in those cases, we start our calcineurin inhibitor and anti-metabolite therapy on the earlier side.
Nice. It's really helpful to hear the general broad strokes, but also some of the subtleties there. And we'll certainly have you guys along the way for every step for managing these immunosuppressive drugs. I'd like to hear your thoughts about rejection. The rejection that we'll see in the ICU, whether it's acute this first couple of days or maybe the first or second postoperative week, what is the difference in the pathophys and how might your treatment be different for those two?
With the use of induction therapy, in our relatively straightforward transplant patients, getting early solumedrol and ATG, we see very, very little rejection. Really looking for that more in our patients who are highly sensitized and or have positive cross-match at time of transplant. So what does that mean? Patients build up anti-HLA antibodies in their system. They can build them up over time. We certainly do every once in a while see patients who have cardiomyopathy and never had surgery or a VAD who have some of these antibodies to other exposures, can be to blood products. It can be an unknown. Generally speaking, those patients aren't presensitized. We see that more in our patients with congenital heart disease who have had prior surgeries, prior blood transfusions, homografts especially. We see it in patients who have exposure to ventricular assist devices for a prolonged period of time. We check patients before they go into transplant for this presensitization. Now, over the last 10 to 15 years, we actually know specifically what anti-HLA antibodies patients have. We can actually look at our HLA profile of our donors before even accepting a heart and know if our patients are at risk for a positive crossmatch. Positive crossmatch is a reaction that occurs at transplant when we mix lymphoid tissue from the donor with serum from our recipient. If you see that reaction, that positive crossmatch, that is something we take very seriously because it has a very, very high risk of antibody-mediated rejection. So those are the patients that we see early rejection in. We treat those patients with positive crossmatch with a specialized immunosuppression protocol where we give them plasmapheresis, wash the blood of these antibodies, and then give them IVIG and rituximab, which is an anti-CD20, anti-B cell monoclonal antibody, to treat this type of rejection. There are sometimes patients who do not have a positive crossmatch at the time of transplant. Oftentimes, it is still the patients who are highly presensitized who may develop early antibody-mediated rejection. These patients, to be honest, they don't oftentimes look all that different than the patients who have primary graft failure and are kind of struggling with issues with function. They may have arrhythmias, especially atrial arrhythmias. If we are surprised by a patient with a negative crossmatch but early antibody-mediated rejection, we'll treat them the same way. We place a VAS cath, we do the plasmapheresis, and treat them for early AMR. All of our patients here get their first biopsy within 7 to 10 days of transplant. We look for cellular rejection. We look for antibody-mediated rejection. To be honest, we very, very rarely, again, especially in the patients who get induction therapy, see cellular rejection on that first biopsy, but you certainly can see antibody-mediated rejection. We're more aggressive with our biopsy and rejection surveillance in the patients who don't get the ATG induction therapy.
Sure. Certainly a comprehensive answer. And again, another thing that we're really happy to have you guys along the way to help manage all of these things. Is a heart biopsy, is that pretty common in heart transplant centers around the U.S.?
It varies from center to center. Historically here, we've been a pretty high volume biopsy center. I think the number of biopsies that a center does kind of correlates to their responsiveness to rejection. There are degrees of rejection, and like anything else in your body, if you have a mild rejection, a lot of times your body can kind of manage that and take care of it. Giving extra immunosuppression to treat mild rejections, immunosuppression is not free, right? It comes with plenty of side effects. Having said that, we do know that early rejection can lead to late rejection, and rejection can lead to development of coronary artery disease in the future. Different centers have different philosophies about their aggressiveness in treating rejection. The centers that tend to be more aggressive treating rejection tend to be the centers that do higher volume of biopsies. In the past, we had a biopsy protocol here where we biopsied our patients in the first year after transplant between, I would say, 7 and 10 times. We have been able to decrease that with better methods for rejection surveillance that are non-invasive. Measurement of donor-specific antibodies is something that has been available now for well over a decade, but we get results really quickly. We get specific antibodies, and we can trend them over time. And then more recently, there's been the development of cell-free DNA testing. We can do a rejection surveillance assay looking at the fraction of donor-specific cell-free DNA, which is a very good screening test for rejection. It is not specific, but it's a very sensitive test. So it's something that we can use as a screening test. And if patients have a negative result, we feel pretty comfortable reducing their number of biopsies. If they have a positive result, we can do a biopsy. Having said that, biopsies are a relatively low-risk procedure, even in our youngest patients. Youngest patients, though, need anesthesia, whereas our older patients sometimes do not. So we try to minimize in our younger patients as well, but it's relatively low-risk, simple right heart catheterization with biopsy.
Sure, that's fascinating. As we move along, I want to get an idea of your overall trajectory that you would expect for these patients moving through the ICU. And maybe we'll focus on our case, relatively a bit more straightforward. The dilated cardiomyopathy came in, got tuned up, got a transplant. We already mentioned maybe get them extubated, maybe 3 days or so post-op. What are the other things on your list that you want to happen before you get that kid out of the ICU? You know, of course, they're going to come off their vasoactives or epi, but what else comes to mind?
So I think it's important to see the respiratory status of our patients. Again, how sick they are going into transplant determines a lot of their recovery time. In our relatively straightforward cardiomyopathy patients, we certainly can see them recover in the ICU for less than a week. And for our complex congenital failed Fontans and our babies, you can see them spend weeks, if not more, in the ICU. It's really hard to counsel families leading into transplant exactly how long that recovery period is going to be. I think the things that you're looking for are respiratory status, obviously the ability to come off of inotropes. I think it is important also to see patients tolerating some degree of feeds. We like to see our patients start to do some rehab, ability to get out of bed in our older patients, in our babies, ability to do some physical therapy and some rehab with parents as well. Having said that, our floor here is very comfortable taking care of complex patients, so we may be a little bit more on the aggressive side, getting them out of the ICU once they're on inotropes and really off positive pressure. It really is patient-by-patient, case-by-case management decision.
We have our patient. He's doing his rehab. He's off his respiratory support. He's feeding well. You know, he's off his vasoactives, getting ready to leave the ICU. Is there any specific short or other long-term complications that, you know, we should be aware of just in terms of anticipatory guidance and, you know, going forward? And, you know, what is survivorship like for a lot of these kids after their heart transplant?
Yeah, so the first thing I'll say is the goal of a pediatric heart transplant is that these patients should be able to do everything that their peers are able to do. We're pretty good at it. If you look at like some quality of life assessments, you'll see that even 1 year post-transplant, only mild restrictions in physical activity in some of the patients and the vast majority of patients with no restrictions of physical activity. These patients should be able to go to school. They should be able to play sports. They should be able to have relationships, really do everything that their peers are able to do. We generally keep our patients who get induction therapy out of school for the first 3 months because their immunosuppression in that period of time is significant and they are at risk for infections. That's really the thing that I would say when you're leaving the ICU. The number one thing to think about, I think, is infection risk, because especially in the patients who get induction therapy. We have all of our patients on infection prophylaxis medications generally for the first 6 months. So what that is Bactrim for prevention of PCP, Nystatin for prevention of thrush, and antiviral for EBV-CMV prophylaxis. These medications are on for the first 6 months, generally speaking. Other things, long-term risk of heart transplant, in addition to the infection rejection stuff. Post-transplant lymphoproliferative disease is one of the side effects that can occur due to immunosuppression. We probably see one or two of the patients that we follow on a yearly basis diagnosed with PTLD severe enough that they're in need of treatment by an oncologic team, likely chemotherapy. That's something that we counsel patients ahead of time about. Even though it is a rare diagnosis, you don't want it to be the first time that they heard that if it were to happen to them. The calcineurin inhibitors especially can be renal toxic. We always have a close eye on patients' creatinines and on their renal function. Oftentimes after several years, patients do have to see nephrologists. We might have to alter our immunosuppression regimen a little bit to try to be as friendly to the kidneys as possible. In terms of very long-term outcomes, up to about 10% of the patients transplanted as kids may end up with end-stage renal disease, hemodialysis, and even kidney transplant. The number one reason why our patients might need a second heart transplant is coronary artery vasculopathy. Coronary disease can happen. It's not 100% understood, but it is an inflammation that occurs in the coronary arteries of transplanted hearts. It's probably related to rejection. It definitely occurs more commonly in patients who have a history of rejection, although sometimes it can happen out of the blue. Because of that, we do surveillance testing of the coronary arteries on a yearly basis. We do a coronary angiography in a left heart catheterization to take a picture of the coronaries. If you see severe disease, that's a reason for retransplantation. Often disease in the coronary arteries of transplanted hearts is diffuse. There are times that it can be seen focally. We can address that with angioplasty and stenting. But if you do that, it's very, very important to keep a very close eye on those patients, because those are coronary arteries that can be hot. They can develop disease in other places. It can progress rapidly. Other reason we have to keep a close eye on this is because these patients are generally, they start asymptomatic. Patients who don't have heart transplant, if they have an issue in the coronary arteries, have ischemia, will get chest pain. That might not happen in a transplant patient because of the denervation of the heart during transplant. So these patients can be symptom-free, and it behooves us to keep a very close eye. There are other tests that can be done in lieu of coronary angiography, such as CAT scans and PET scans, that are more commonly used in adults and our older pediatric patients. But in this center, we do a yearly angiogram.
Oh, wow.
Certainly is helpful to hear all the many number of things that can happen for these patients. I have a question. Maybe as we're getting towards the end of our recording today, when I'm thinking about these kids, I'm always worried about potential for graft failure, especially if they're lost to follow-up or don't have as well access to care as they did previously. If we get a phone call from maybe a community center, maybe this kid came into the ER at a small place with symptoms of heart failure, is there anything specific about the post-op heart transplant patient that should direct how we counsel that physician on the other side of the phone to stabilize this patient before they get to our ICU? Is there anything unique that we'd like to pass along to them?
So I think it's important to know that rejection mimics other things that are more common in pediatrics, right? Like infectious issues, like gastro. I think it's important to always have your antenna up for rejection in these patients as they come through the ER or ICU and you're triaging their calls. When you're thinking about a patient who you believe is a transplant patient in rejection, these are patients that can go south very quickly. Always important to have that decision tree in your mind about what's the best way to transport this patient here. What type of center are they in? Are they in a community center? Are they in a different center that has anesthesia availability, ECMO availability, things like that? Because if they're in a community center, the most important thing might be, let's get them here as quickly as we can. But knowing that they can go south pretty quickly, if they're in a center that has the capability to intubate very quickly to do ECMO, is it maybe the right thing to intubate the patient there, even if you know that there's a risk that they can even maybe have a cardiac arrest, but they have the proper services there? Because transporting a patient not intubated who can go south very quickly, as you guys know, in the ICU, may not be the best thing for the patient. I think it's important to know where they are, what the capabilities are, and thinking about your decision tree about what's the best to do prior to transport. There are even times where our fellows, I know, go to other centers and in touch with our ECMO team and making decisions sort of on the fly about what's best for each patient. Mobile ECMO is a different story. Not for this. Not for this talk.
Definitely impressive.
Yeah.
All right. Well, Warren and Gav, thank you both so much for joining us today. Is there anything else you'd like to discuss or key points you'd like to mention before we wrap up?
Definitely not the Eagles, Gav. That's not on the not on the list of things. They win the
Super Bowl. We could totally talk about that now if you want.
Oh, my God. They're going to win the Super Bowl. Oh, God.
Dear awful listener, you probably know who won the Super Bowl at this point.
Solid point.
I'm good. I'm good. I really appreciate you guys having me on. I hate hearing my own voice, so I don't look forward to hearing this, but that's okay.
It's going to be great.
No, this is like the perfect overview. I think about all the new PICU fellows who don't have an interest in transplant. Like,
they're going to be terrified, though. It sounds all...
I mean, they should be a little scared, you know?
Appropriately terrified. All right.
Perfect.
Yeah, cool. I appreciate it. Thank you.
Yeah. Thanks so much, guys. And thank you for listening to this episode of Pete's Crit. Please remember that all content during this episode is intended for informational and educational purposes only. It should not be used as replacement for medical advice. The views expressed during this episode by hosts and our guests are their own and do not reflect the official position of their institutions. If you have any comments, suggestions, or feedback, you can email us at PetesCritPodcast@gmail.com or find us on Twitter @CritPeds and @PetesCrit on Instagram for real-time show updates. If you enjoyed the show, please subscribe, rate, and review in your favorite podcasting application and share with your colleagues. Also, if you'd like to support the making of the podcast, please see the description for Venmo information and how to become a Patreon. Any donation will be appreciated. Thank you again for listening, and goodbye.